Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Coming up, we've got all the news and views from Manchester City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
Well, there's nothing quite like a last-minute winner to give you an injection of positivity before a tricky cup semi-final in a season where things haven't quite gone to plan, is there? It's been the Blue Gloom podcast for a lot of this term, but thanks to a pair of good results in what were difficult games for Manchester City, we're all smiley, happy flowers here again. On this week's show, we'll discuss the performances against Everton and Aston Villa, pick out some key moments from some key players, and look at how that all affects the race for the top five. The Premier League campaign is on ice for the coming week too, as City head back to Wembley in the FA Cup. We'll hear from journalist and Nottingham Forest fan Daniel Story about that game a little bit later on. Since it's all been good news on the pitch this week, we've decided that the downbeat on today's show is going to have to come from some form of nostalgia. We're looking back at Stuart Pearce's time in charge of the club. It's 20 years ago he became City manager, and a week with a fixture against Nottingham Forest seems the right time to get into how that all turned sour for him so quickly at Eastlands. I'm David Mooney, and joining me this week I've got City fan Helen Powell.
Ahoy, hoy.
And the chief football writer at BBC Sport, Phil McNulty.
Hello there.
Hi, Phil. Good to have you on for first Blue Moon podcast debut. So welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Thank you. I'm good, thank you. Very good. Getting ready for the end of the season and all the exciting bits, yeah.
Excellent. Helen, first time this season as well for you. So how are you doing?
Yeah, I'm grand. I'd say a fair bit's changed since last time I was on, which I'm sure might pick up on in a bit. But yeah, all good.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we'll get into that. And obviously, I touched on it in the intro there. We love a last-minute goal at City. Helen, you're not allowed to say Paul Dickhoff or Sergio no. Aguero because they're far too obvious. So come on, let's go a little bit more obscure than that, a bit more niche. Best last-minute goals you've seen City score?
See, again, I wouldn't say niche, but I was at Southampton for Gabby J's last-minute 100 points of... I don't think I've ever seen a limbs like it. It was quite something. It was a glorious day after quite a not much going on in the match, really. But yeah, it was a absolutely wonderful end to that season. That was next level.
I should have put that in there as one that you're not allowed to have either, because that's another fairly obvious one. So,
the only other one I can think of off the top of my head didn't even stand. It's still too painful to talk about. But again, talking about insane celebrations, it would be Raheem. So I'm like, nah, I can't even bring myself to say it.
Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, Phil, you're not a City fan, but any last minute goals of City's that have caused you to have major rewrites in the press box?
Well, there's one above all, isn't there, which is Sergio Aguero's goal, because basically in the last 5 minutes we had City losing the league to Manchester United. We had City threatening to pinch the league from Manchester United when Edin Dzeko equalised. And then, of course, the finale of Sergio Aguero scoring that famous goal. So if you're talking Manchester City famous last-minute goals, I would go with that one. Although I suppose if you want to be really old about it, and probably neither of you would ever remember it, maybe Tommy Booth in the 1969 FA Cup semi-final against Everton at Villa Park. Now, Tommy Booth will remember it, whether you two did, I don't know, but that was a very famous one, because obviously that led on to City winning the FA Cup against Leicester City, Neil Young scoring with a very typical Neil Young goal, as I seem to recall.
Yeah, it's slightly before my time, I'm afraid, that one, Phil. But I will chuck in. Helen, I don't know if you remember these, but two of my favourite last-minute City goals. Micah Richards at Villa Park in the FA Cup when it all looked lost. It looked like David James, who'd gone up for the corner, nearly flicked it away from him as well. And then he swore on telly as well, which makes it even better, of course. And Stephen Ireland against Reading at Eastlands, where he volleyed it in the last second. And it, beautiful goal. All like in the Sven season, everyone thought the game was lost. And then Andreas Isaacson runs the length of the pitch to celebrate with him. Like, two beautiful, beautiful last minute finishes. So if we've missed any, get in touch at Blue Moon Podcast on all the socials. You can email contact at bluemoonpodcast.com as well. Let us know your favourite last minute City goals. Time to look at the news from this week, though, because in both of these games, Helen, I'm wondering as a fan, if you'd have taken a draw at Goodison, and then if you'd have taken a draw against Villa, keep everything nice and tight.
Yeah.
And it turns out City have won them both. So it's kind of like a bonus 4 points, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I'll definitely take it. I think the way the season's gone, sort of, you know, not to the way everything's always gone apart from the last sort of 10 years, you do still learn not to expect too much. And I thought, yeah, we'll get a point there, look at what's coming up. But yeah, happy days.
Yeah. Phil, in terms of the performances from City, have you seen anything different in the last kind of week compared to the rest of the season? Obviously, you look back at that December-January period, City were very fragile. But it feels like they've got a little bit more determination, a bit more steel about them at the moment.
Well, certainly. You looked at those two fixtures, and I've seen City a lot this season. And like you, I would imagine, a lot of it has disappointed me and surprised me at how they've fallen off a cliff from the standards they had before. But I certainly thought last week at Everton, maybe for the first hour or so until James Tarkowski got injured, I thought they were still a bit flat then. But again, once Doku came on, and Doku's, I find, a very interesting player in that, again, having watched City a lot, I keep thinking, come on, give us more. When I say us, I mean people watching, not City. And yet in the last two games, he's come on and he's really made big contributions. And I thought while they got over the line late on against Everton, who the game changed maybe on Tarkowski only off because Michael Keane came on very low on confidence and City then just took complete control. Against Villa, I thought that was a lot more like the City of old. I mean, it was against a very, very good side. They almost conceded in the opening seconds. They then were pulled back by the penalty. But I thought second half, that to me was much more like the Manchester City of old. And the goal, the winning goal, was a goal I think I've seen hundreds of times at Manchester City where somebody's got to the byline, pulled it back. And in this case, it was Doku, then Nunes, arriving at the far post to score. That, for many years, almost seemed the trademark City goal for me. And they did, to me, look a lot more like the old Manchester City against Villa. They were presented with a big challenge because Villa going really well. I was at Villa Park when they ran PSG, who again I saw really give Man City a working over in Paris. They gave them a right wobble in that second half. So it was a big game. Obviously the stakes were high because of the Champions League placings. And I just thought maybe last half hour or so, that was a lot more like the Manchester City putting on the pressure, intensity, creating chances. Marmoush had the goal disallowed not long before the end, didn't he? And then they won it. And I just felt it was a lot more like the Manchester City that we've seen over the years. Not to the standard, obviously, but there was something there that maybe I've not seen on quite a lot of occasions this season. And obviously, you saw Pep's celebration. He knew how much that meant.
Yeah, Helen, I wonder if it was the control element that was back because you think especially against Villa, it was starting to creep in against Everton. But you think of the times this season where the other team have been allowed to get a foothold in the game and then they start creating chances. It felt very much like Villa and Everton's chances this week were isolated moments that City actually dealt with quite well in spells. And the fact that they've only conceded a goal from a penalty, it kind of suggests that there's a little bit more stability there.
Yeah, I feel like things are ramping up right towards the end of the season. But, you know, we've seen this with many different Pep teams over the years that new players tend to take a season or so to bed in and to get into the way the team is, the stability, the control. And I think with having so many changes in January as well, we've seen that, you know, it's still very much a work in progress. We all know we've got the old guard, the new guard, you know, there's a lot going on. But I think very much the way we want to play is we need to control. And when we can't control, when we lose the ball, when a bad part, you know, you can see at times this season, that's when it's just completely fallen apart. And I say, if we need to get back to that strength and that stability, then we're going to be, you know, hopefully better for next season.
Yeah, definitely. Phil, give us some reason to be calm now, because you can look at this with a neutral eye. The top five, as it stands, City in third on 61 points, Forest in fourth on 60 points with a game in hand, Newcastle in fifth on 59 with a game in hand, Chelsea in sixth on 57 with a game in hand, and then Villa in seventh on 57 as well. It's awfully tight. Can you make the case that City are going to make it for us, please?
I can, because at this time of the season, Manchester City are used to the pressures of, in recent seasons, chasing titles. We've seen them on two or three occasions go right to the wire and win. I think the other night was huge against Villa. I think to get that win, to get that little bit of breathing space. And I think, as we said, in the last half hour, it was a lot more like the old Manchester City. Obviously, they're missing people like Haaland and Rodri. I mean, when you looked at the two of them together on the bench the other night, just chatting away, you thought, you know, any team in the world would miss those two players, you know, anyone at all. And I just think they're used to these situations. They're starting to play a little bit better. I thought the tempo has come back into the game a little bit more. I thought at Everton, for the first half hour, they were too slow, too much passing sideways and backwards, maybe too patient. But there was a lot more intensity against Villa. And I think, albeit because they're not going to win the league or the Champions League, there will be a tinge of disappointment about the season. It would not surprise me at all if not only did they make the Champions League play. In fact, it would be a big surprise to me if they didn't make the Champions League places. I think you can make a strong case for them winning the FA Cup now as well. Obviously, the romantics would like someone else to win it. Not particularly because they're against City, but just because they wouldn't mind a different name on the trophy. But I think you could make a case for them winning the FA Cup and qualifying for the Champions League, which, given everything that's gone on and some of the performances that they've delivered, is acceptable, if not up to Manchester City's usual incredibly high standards of winning four successive Premier Leagues and throwing in the Champions League and a couple of other honours in there as well in past years.
Yeah. Helen, are you relaxed about it now? Are you more relaxed? Not necessarily relaxed.
No. I thought, you know, when it was quite clear earlier on in the season, I was like, not this time. You know, I sort of was like, it does show the incredible achievement of the last four seasons. We'll take a season off. You know, we've got lots of squad changes, all these things we've spoken about. And I thought, you know, selfishly, again, I was like, well, it's probably a good season. I'm not going to get to the road that much. And, you know, I just wanted a break from the mental gymnastics. I didn't want to be up 3 o'clock in the morning looking at a league table, doing the what ifs and putting it back through the predictor and looking. And here we are. We're doing it again, but just for a different. I think knowing it, with the fifth position as well, it does take a bit of the pressure off potentially. But you never know. It's not over till it's over.
Yeah. How about catching Arsenal in second? More drop points this week. That would be a nice cheeky end to the season, wouldn't it?
I was actually angry when that idea came into my head. It's like, no, stop it. Calm down.
It's like when Spurs famously finished third in a two-horse race, didn't they? That's what people said, you know, when it was... I think they chased Leicester all season, hadn't they? And then suddenly right at the end, Arsenal... pipped them, so people said that, you know, they'd finished sort of third in a two-horse race, which obviously was fairly painful. I think City will not be catching Arsenal. That's my view on that one, but I can certainly see them finishing third, no problem at all.
Yeah, well, we'll definitely take third, and if they can guarantee that in the next few weeks, there's the form, Helen, is actually quite good. City are the second form team in the league behind Wolves of all teams. Wolves won five, City have won four, drawn one.
That's crazy. This feels like warm up, hopefully, for next season at this point. So. Yeah, it's a good place to end.
Just looking at City's fixtures as well, they would have certainly taken those last few games, wouldn't they? I'm looking at it now. Wolves at home, Southampton away, Bournemouth at home, then Fulham away. I think it would be a major shock now if they didn't qualify for the Champions League. In fact, I can see them doing it when the final tallies are added up. I can see them doing it quite comfortably.
Yeah, we won't say it. We're as City fans, we won't say home and host, but as we'll allow you to kind of put everybody's minds at ease, Phil. Let's talk about Matias Nunes, because Phil, I think he's a player that deserves some attention this week, given the amount of flack he's taken at City for ultimately being played out of position, ultimately not being good enough really for City's central midfield. And I think this is one of those weeks where you have to kind of say, you know what, fair play.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been as questioning as everybody else when I've seen him playing at right back. He just hasn't looked like a right back to me. And that's because he isn't a right back. It's as simple as that. And as you say, he's not been good enough to force his way into City's midfield. But you've seen his impact this week. He created the vital opening goal at Everton. And of course, he was then on the end of that cross from Doku. For the winner the other night, which could be a huge goal in City's season. I think most people would accept that. It's a shame in a way that he's not been able to force his way into the City midfield, because that is clearly his position. Pep chose to use him at right back, and I, along with many others, and I still don't think he's a right back. But as you say, for a player who's had a lot of criticism and a lot of scrutiny, when he does well, you have to give him credit. And it's shown a lot of character as well. He's not sort of hidden away playing in a position he doesn't like. He's, you know, even when he's played badly, he's never been hiding away. And this week he's got his rewards. As you say, he set up that vital first goal at Everton when it looked like it could end in a goalless draw. And then that huge contribution this week, arriving perfectly timed at the far post. A little bit of a tricky finish as well, because it was quite a tight angle. But he finished it really well.
Yeah, it wasn't easy, was it? Yeah.
It wasn't as easy as you look. When you look at that again, it was a tricky finish, that one, because it was a very tight angle, but he did it. And as you say, you know, when people have had flack, and he has, when he comes through it and he produces the goods, he's done in two big, big games in succession, then you must give him credit and he deserves it.
Yeah. Helen, I was right behind that finish. My seat, it was pretty much directly in line with where his boot connected with the ball between the goal. So I knew he'd scored before he'd scored, because I could see it going in. It's one of the best feelings in football, knowing that the ball is going to go in before everybody else. You have to, like Phil was saying, you have to give him the credit for being in that position. He's been working hard all season. And especially when you consider where he was in December, because you think back to that Manchester derby, you give away a penalty, you give the ball away, and then give the penalty away. And it would have been very easy for him to just kind of fold on his City career at that point and crumble into like disappearing into the background. But he hasn't. He's stuck to it. He's worked hard. And like, to be fair, he deserves the credit this week.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say all is forgiven. I think all is mainly forgiven, but you've just reminded me of the derby, and I'm like,
forgiven. Oh. Some is forgiven.
But yeah, I think he's, as I say, amazing character, and he has been played out of position. I think, you know, with the Rodri injury, it's not the team he thought he'd be playing with and players around. It's been difficult, and say, I think it's amazing that he's come back like this, and I'd say 80% forgiven, but... If you asked me the other night, I was singing his praises, saying, I've never said that.
Yeah. I also want to ask Helen about Nico O'Reilly, because it seems a thing now that City just don't have left backs. They just put somebody else at left back, and Nico O'Reilly's name has come out of the random name generator. But a lot of the stability, I think, from the last few weeks, you can put down to the fact that he's there. Gvardiol's been moved inside, and they now have the left foot, right foot balance at the centre backs. And O'Reilly scored against Everton. He knows where to go in the kind of final third, and he's been pretty solid defensively as well.
I think he's been incredible. I think it is. I think it seems that the players all trust him as well. You can see that stability is the core, especially with Gvardiol, like you said, the left right. They're really gelling, and it's wonderful to see. I think. You get nervous because we've seen this before. You think you don't want to be played all the time because Pep... But I do trust that Pep knows how and when to play him like this. But it is great. I think he's fantastic. And the only issue is that I always want to do a bad Basil Fawlty impression when I talk about him. But I did it once and I think I got away with it or something, you know. But
He's got 5 goals now, hasn't he? He's got 5 goals, which is quite a return for somebody playing in that position. And... He offers things defensively, but also in an attacking role. I mean, I was at Bournemouth when he came on, when really City shouldn't have been behind in that game. I know everyone at the half-time it was 1-0, but City had loads of chances. Haaland had missed a penalty, but Pep threw him on, played him on the left-hand side, and he immediately set up a goal for Haaland. And I think he was involved in the second one as well. But also, you know, what he offers going forward, not just goals. I mean, he put a cross in the other night. I can't remember who it was for, but it was just played into that 6-yard area. And it was just a natural attacking fullback's delivery, really. It was so good. But also, I think his natural position was probably number 10, isn't it? But I think he's shown what he can do. He's shown what he can do at left back. He's got the build for it. He's tall. He's athletic. He's skillful. And I think he's been a great find. We saw McAtee the other night again, a great talent, one that's come through the academy. It would have been great if that little lob had gone in, that he was instinctively controlled it and lifted it, but it was just wide. So I think...
Phil, if that had gone in, I don't think I'd have made it home by now. I think I'd still be out.
Well, you're looking for things, as you say, to make you feel more relaxed, not just about the end of this season, but about next season. I mean, obviously, there's talk of clubs being interested in McAtee. I think Nottingham Forest were the latest. Interesting to see what City do there, because I wouldn't be selling him in a hurry. And obviously, Nico O'Reilly has made such an impression this season that you could see him, barring alternatives pitching up, you could play him at left-back next season, because he looks totally comfortable there and offers City stuff in defence and creatively as well. And he's chipped in with 5 goals. It's more than chipped in. 5 goals is a great return for a young player like that. So I think they are certainly two huge positives. But O'Reilly in particular just looks made for this level and looks the sort of player who will be perfectly at home in a Pep Guardiola team.
Yeah, there's something about playing left-back that makes you City's second most dangerous goal threat as well, behind Erling Haaland. I don't really understand how that works, but you know, you play left-back, you suddenly pop up with all the goals. That's how it happens.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
Looking to upgrade your bathroom without the hassle or the wait? Say hello to Blissful Baths, the stress-free way to transform your space into a relaxing retreat. Right now, Blissful Baths is offering 12 months with no payments and no interest. That's right, zero payments and zero interest for a whole year. Even better, they can replace your walk-in shower or bath in as little as one day. No mess, no long waits. Just a beautiful new bath space, fast. And here's the cherry on top. You can get up to 20% off with instant manufacturer rebates, plus extra savings for seniors and first responders. Ready to turn your bathroom into your own personal spa? Go to blissfulbaths.com today to request your free consultation. That's blissfulbaths.com. You deserve affordable luxury.
Please give us your backing. Patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Phil, can I get your view on the penalty as well? Because obviously the replay that was shown in the stadium after the decision was overturned caused a lot of anger, caused a lot of frustration, because it looked on the screen pretty much like Ruben Dias got a touch on the ball. When you watch the different angles and the different replays, it's very hard to tell whether he actually does get a touch on the ball. Does it stop it being a foul if he touches the ball?
I don't know, because he then went through and touched the player as well. I think it was a bit inadvertent, but I think he caught the back leg just slightly, which threw him off balance. So to me, it was a penalty. I can understand why City fans... It's one of those classic incidents. If it happens to you, you think it's not a penalty. If it happens for you, you think it is a penalty. Yeah. And I would side just with it. I would side with it just being a penalty, because I think he did try to get out the way, as Pep demonstrated with that strange little dance he did on the touchline. But I think he just nicked his back leg and that threw him off balance. So that to me was a penalty. Fortunately for Pep's state of mind and happiness, it didn't affect the final outcome. But I think on balance, I would say that was probably just a penalty. But it's that fine line. As you say, two sets of fans will view that completely differently.
Yeah. Alan, when you consider it that... ultimately, I think what a lot of fans are frustrated with is that the VAR was brought into play there, because it seemed like the referee had a very good view of it, and like we were promised that VAR wouldn't re-referee games, wouldn't be asked to look at decisions that the referee had seen. Now, we don't know what the referee has and hasn't seen. That's the only person who knows that is the referee and what he describes to the VAR. But it feels like one of them where in another game they probably wouldn't be referred to the screen. And I think that's what causes a lot of frustration, isn't it?
Yeah, again, it's the inconsistency in the way that it's used. It's the inconsistency in the way that, say, you have to do an all or nothing. I think this debate's been done over and over and over. The issue, it's kind of like, if you look by the laws of the game, contact, that's a penalty. But the you need to know what the referee saw. It's kind of also physics and velocity. You look at the speed he's running, there's not what else, and say, yeah, Pep was like, nothing else he can do to fall would have been more dangerous. But I just think it's inconsistency. It has to be ref always checks, ref doesn't check, because otherwise it's, again, it's leaving it up to opinion. It's, you know, I saw it, maybe I did, maybe I didn't. And with it being shown on the screen as well, I think the initial, my first criticism of VAR when it was implemented is it's always the detriment of the fans at the game, because you don't know. But also when at home, you're seeing it from every angle, you're seeing all the stuff on the screen, you see, and it's still a disconnect. It just doesn't seem right, and it doesn't seem consistent enough at all.
I'm not sure it should be shown, because that will create a lot of angst in the stadium. But I can, on my hobby horse of VAR, when it first came in, I thought, great, I'm all for this. And the more I've seen it, the more I've experienced it, the less a fan I am of it. Because you got Ange Postecoglou made a point the other week about it took 6.5 minutes to decide whether someone had been fouled to then disallow a goal Spurs had scored at Chelsea. I mean, that can't be right, can it? That can't be right. It's almost like maybe you should have a time cut off. If you haven't decided after 60 seconds, then the referee's decision stands. But again, we hear all these things about, you know, there's going to be a higher bar for referee, if you like, interference, if you like, to go back into it. Nothing seems to have changed to me. Nothing at all seems to have changed. Even the automated offside that's been brought in, that still seems to take ages to be decided. I am absolutely not a fan of VAR anymore. I thought, in theory, it's great, but also that clear and obvious thing, I got that. But now it's almost like they're looking for ways to disallow goals. And you've got this thing where, what do you go to a football match to see and enjoy? A goal being scored. That's what you actually go to see. And now fans are going to football matches, and pretty much everybody, and I bet you two are the same. If a goal is scored, you almost instinctively think, well, will they disallow it? And that, to me, takes away the absolute essential enjoyment of football. Players work all week to score a goal. Fans go to football matches to see goals scored. And I just think one of the essential, integral parts of the joy of watching football is in the process of being taken away. And that's why I'm not in favour at all anymore. Apart from maybe goal line technology, which is, you know, pretty much spot
instant,
on.
Yeah.
And automated offside, I'm perfectly comfortable with that, providing it then doesn't take 5 or 6 minutes to do it. But in general, it's put me right off.
Well, back to the top of the show. Imagine Aguero, imagine Dickov, imagine playing all that back, but half the ground's going, oh, wait for it. It's just, you know, it's not, not the same.
Yeah. We'll probably come back to this as the season goes on, because it's not going to go away anytime soon. But for now, it's time to turn our attention to Sunday's FA Cup tie. City go into this one on the back of three quite impressive victories and with confidence quite high. Nottingham Forest, meanwhile, had a handy win over Spurs on Monday night to put a stop to their recent downturn in form. I've been speaking to the journalist and Forest fan Daniel Storey to find out what to expect from them at Wembley as they balance the FA Cup and the push for Champions League football.
I think the FA Cup feels like the freer hit of the two. When we went to Wembley for the playoff final in 2022, I don't think... I think if you'd have told Forest fans that they'd be back there in 3 years, then it would be because we're in another playoff final, not because we're in an FA Cup semi-final with a chance of of a first domestic final since the early 90s. So, yeah, I mean, it's a freer hit of the two. In a sense, I think Forest's recent run in the league, that they lost two games in a row. They lost to Villa and they lost to Everton at home before beating Spurs. And I think those two defeats in a row almost made fans realise just how far we've come this season. You know, you look at the squad reverting to the mean with a couple of injuries. You look at the players that other teams are bringing off the bench and you think, oh, hang on a minute, we've got no right to be here. So sort of everything feels a bit freer again than it did. But yeah, the FA Cup is definitely now, having beaten Spurs, the FA Cup is right. Just go and give that a go, whatever happens.
Yeah. What at this stage now, and we're talking before City have played Villa, so this could change things slightly in terms of league positions, but you're still very much in the mix at this point. What represents a good end of season from here on in? Because there's five games left for Forest. You've had that third place for a long time now. It kind of feels like a disappointment if you don't make it, but you are still the overachievers of the bunch there.
Yeah, I think there's two things to say. Firstly, you're absolutely right. There would be a tinge of disappointment. I think that would be eliminated very, very quickly. You know, we're talking hours after that final day. And one complicating factor in that is if Aston Villa beat Crystal Palace in that first FA Cup semi-final, then seventh place will get Europa League. So I think Europa League, with the games Forest would play, with the teams they'd possibly face, that would feel a lot different to Conference League football as a reward, which sounds an extraordinary thing for me to be saying as a Forest fan, because European football for the first time since 95-96 would be ridiculous on any level. But yeah, it's in our hands now. On paper, we have a fairly decent run in. No easy games, you'd say, although Leicester at home should be won if we want to finish in the top five. But just
it's a derby, though, isn't fixtures, it? That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly right. But then fixtures like, you know, Brentford at home, West Ham away, Palace away, where you think, well, we've got more to play for than them, and if we perform to the abilities that we have this season, we should have a decent chance of getting in the top five. They are also teams who will be quite happy to let us have the ball, which is what Everton did and thwarted us and kind of did a job on us with that style. But look, we've been in the top five teams in the league now for 33 of the 38 games. So what's the point in losing faith now, right?
Yeah. Well, so has anything changed since the game at the City Ground? Because when City went there, six weeks ago, it felt like a really, really tough place to go. And then you lost a couple of games. And I'm wondering if anything has changed at Forest after that.
I think it's a very light squad. Deliberately light from Nuno in terms of numbers, but also even within those numbers, there are players who at any other club, in probably even in the top half, wouldn't be having a chance. You know, you look at those reserve wingers, Jota and Ramon Sosa. We played Tottenham on Monday night and they brought on Lucas Bergvall, Brennan Johnson and Dominic Solanke to try and change the game, and James Maddison stayed on the bench. There's just not the depth there. Chris Wood's been injured for a while. At the same time, Tao Aruni was injured for a while, so we had to play no striker at all. Ola Aina is still out and probably will be out for the weekend, and he has been, amid huge competition, arguably Forest's best outfield player this season. And there has been a sense of the defensive stability which we enjoyed, particularly in that home game against City. It's not quite been there. Maybe fatigue, maybe just kind of, you know, relentlessness trying to sit back and soak up pressure just hasn't worked in quite the same way. But I think that win at Spurs has come at an absolutely brilliant time for Forest, and probably not a great time for City, because if we'd have lost that game and lost three in a row going into the semi, I think everyone would have felt like the season was slightly starting to, not fall apart, but just revert back to its likely mean. Now everybody's re-engaged again, I think.
Yeah, just on the on that game as well, the last time that the teams met, you mentioned Everton being happy for Forest to have the ball. That's not how City approach it. It's not how Guardiola will approach it. Does that give you a little bit of positivity going into this one? Because obviously it's at Wembley, it's a different arena, but it's still with the same sort of game. You expect City to have a lot of the ball. You expect Forest to have to hold the position.
Yeah, I think it will come down to two things. Firstly, City's Wembley know-how. For all that, the playoff final is a joyous memory for Forest. There's only there's two players in the Forest squad who were there then. One is Ryan Yates, who was at Forest, and one is Harry Toffoler, who played for Huddersfield against us that day. There is not a lot of Wembley experience there, and City have all of that. And maybe that counts for nothing, but I tend to think in the big moments it probably counts for quite a lot. The players will be nervous. They won't have done that before as a team. For all the distance they've come this season, they haven't quite had this before. I think that will help. And also, I think it will come down to finishing in those moments. You know, they look at the game at the Etihad this season, and the 3-0 looked really comprehensive, but Chris Wood had a chance, a one-on-one chance at 1-0 that we've seen this season that Forest have been better than they ever have before at making those moments count. That's what's defined this season. They didn't do that away at City. If they're going to win at Wembley, they're going to have to do that, because they are going to sit back. They are going to look to hit on the break. And Forest are probably going to have seven or fewer shots, and they're probably going to have to score with two of them, I think. it's how they move from defensive solidity and how quickly they can move from that to attacking transitions and creating clear-cut chances for a fit again Chris Wood.
Yeah, do you feel, I mean, the last time they played as well, City were very much still in their funk of the season. They were still really struggling. Performances have got slightly better since then. The City are actually unbeaten since that Forest game. Do you feel this is a different City as well?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I'm not saying that everything is suddenly perfect. I'm not saying that it doesn't now require a summer clear out, because I think we're way past that. You know this more than me, but we're way past that point now with certain individuals. But I think, A, the mindset of the team seems to have shifted a little bit, and that comeback win against Crystal Palace with some swagger was really instrumental with that. And I also think you're seeing certain areas of the team that look better than they have all season. So Omar Marmoush coming in, he looks dangerous every time he gets the ball. Nico O'Reilly on that left-hand side looks like he's added just some unpredictability to City that I think when Forest played City at the City ground, we would have accepted losing the game, but I think we knew what to expect from City. I think we knew how they would create their attacks, and I think Nuno prides himself on having a defensive plan to stop predictable attacks. I think City are a little bit less predictable now, and that is a worry. And couple that with the injuries that Forest got, and we should say the suspensions, because neither Ryan Yates nor Nico Williams are available for the game through suspension. I think that's a defining factor in the match. Forest are not going to have Ola Aina through injury, they're not going to have Nico Williams, and they're not going to have Ryan Yates. And they are three of Forest's best defensive players. So if City get ahead of steam and become a little bit less predictable than they were at the City ground, I think they'll create a lot of chances.
Yeah. How do you see Nuno approaching this one? Because he actually, weirdly, has a really good record against City.
Yeah, I remember before that game at the City ground this season, I was thinking back to a game that Wolves won 2-0 at the Etihad when Adama Traore scored like 80 minutes and 85 minutes, and they were both those breakaway goals. And it reminded me exactly of Forest's win at Anfield this season, when they sat back first half and then just looked to shift it with about, it was 30 minutes to go at Anfield, it was 20 minutes to go in that Wolves-City game. I think he'll look to do exactly the same thing. The question is whether he goes to a back three. Harry Toffolo played against Spurs on Monday night. It's his first league start of the season. He's more comfortable as a wing-back. Without Nico there and without Ola Aina there, there is a gap at right-back that someone's going to have to fill. I wonder if he might do that with Nico Dominguez, a midfielder, or even Callum Hudson-Odoi, a winger, and play wing-backs. But if he doesn't, then Forest are really going to have to look after those wingers, because, you know, it doesn't matter who it is, we are really short of fullback for this semi-final.
Yeah, the game at the City ground again was defined by a brilliant performance from Morgan Gibbs-White and a great finish from Callum Hudson-Odoi, which I still look at Edison and think maybe near post, mate, can you keep that one out? But still, you know, you got to hit the target and get it in. How dangerous are counterattacks for Forest this season? Because we talk about Forest accepting the other team having the ball, but there's still an element of you have to take your chances when you get them. I know XG is one of the stats that people decry, but is this one of those seasons where Forest just seem to score everything that they get?
Yeah, they create big chances, and there is an element of surprise that defences aren't ready for Chris Wood's movement, even though it's been happening for not just this season but for most of the last decade in the Premier League to greater or lesser extents. Forest surprise teams. The difference between this season and others in the Premier League is that previously, when Morgan Gibbs-White got the ball, he had to do everything. Often he was the guy winning back the ball, and then he was having to play the first pass, and then he was having to set up the chances. With Elliot Anderson in that central midfield, he is either the one winning the ball back or the first pass goes to Elliot Anderson, and it's then that he can release Morgan Gibbs-White. This is kind of technical, I guess, but I would suspect that Gibbs-White is receiving the ball 5 or 10 yards higher up the pitch than he was in each of the last two seasons. And what that means is, when you've got the pace of Elanga or Hudson-Odoi or both, they know that as soon as Elliot Anderson gets the ball, they're like two chess moves ahead. They're already going even before Gibbs-White gets the ball. And so when we play that pass, it's amazing the amount of space that you saw it for the goal at City Ground. Gibbs-White, someone wins the ball, Gibbs-White gets it, and he knows where Hudson-Odoi is. So he sprays that pass out, And it's silly. Like, Forest have only got one player in the opposition half, and yet that player has 15 yards of space and is able to get a shot away. So that'll be the game plan again. I would suspect that Guardiola is pretty well prepared for it. He knows Hudson-Odoi is going to be fit, Alanga's fit again. He will expect either one or both of those in tandem to try and do the same thing, and will be prepared to stop it. I think it's really interesting with the Nico Riley growth into that team, how Guardiola approaches that, because that feels like Forest's best chance, right? If O'Reilly's slightly caught up the field and we've got a right winger that can get in behind, that's how the goal came at the City ground. So how do City stop that will be really interesting.
Yeah, well, it's charity bet time, Daniel. Let's see. Let's money where your mouth is time. Let's see what you think's going to happen. How's it going to go? Give us a score.
I mean, I'm going to go for patriotism and optimism over charity donation, I think. It'll be tight. I will say, look, I can't leave Forest now, given what we've done in the FA Cup all season. So I'll say Forest to win on penalties.
We need a full-time score, though, at 90 minutes. So what are you having?
2-2.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Daniel Storey speaking to me about the game at the weekend. Now, Helen, Daniel is worried about City's Wembley know-how. How big a factor do you think that could be this weekend? Because this is the 15th season in a row that City have been to Wembley for a game. The last season they didn't go there was the one that started with Mark Hughes as manager and ended with Roberto Mancini being the manager at the end of the season. And they've had 27 visits in that time, plus two league games at Spurs as well. If there's any team that has Wembley know-how at the new Wembley, it's City, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, not as confident these days, but there was a season everyone was calling it Etihad South and all that. I think that's definitely a factor, but also, I don't want to say it. I look back to, you know, what's gone on the last little trips. I'm like, although we all know that was obviously part of the wider plan to keep Ten Hag in a job. Let's leave it there. But, you know, it wasn't. It's not.
No, but look how it's gone. Ten Hag's kept them up this season.
Oh, Ben, that is the most annoying. Sorry, it's off topic. One of the most frustrating bits of this season is that all these headlines about City in disaster, what an awful season, and say hopefully we're on for a top 4-5 finish. What about them? What about Spurs? Why are we not enjoying this more? I'm furious, David, but sorry.
But yeah, City, Wembley know-how.
Yeah, and I'd say we should be more confident, but again, the season Spurs... The season Forest are having, it's unbelievable, so I've been ambitious in my guesses, but I think anything could happen, really.
Yeah, yeah. Phil, Helen's right. Forest are having quite a season, and in many ways, you look at the other semi-finalists, and when the draw was made, I didn't really fancy City against any of them. But now City have got a little bit more momentum behind them. Forest have been able to stop that momentum. It should be quite an interesting game on Sunday, shouldn't it?
It will be. I've seen a fair bit of Forest this season, and they are, you know, they've had just a fantastic season, and they play in a certain way that will not suit everybody, but they have this sort of counter-attacking style where they almost let the opposition have the ball. Letting Manchester City have the ball, it's not a great idea in my opinion, but they beat City at the City ground recently. They've had a brilliant season. They've perfected the art of the way they play. They've got two centre-halves in Milenkovic and Murillo who you would not want to meet on a dark night. They are two top-class centre-halves, bought for a song, really. The amount of, I think they only paid something like 20-odd million or something for the pair of them. Great business. And they've got a really good goalkeeper in Matt Sells. They play with Chris Wood, who's having the season of his life up front. And usually two pacey wingers, Elanga, Callum Hudson-Odoi, and then Morgan Gibbs-White and Elliot Anderson. So they've got quality right through the team. They're a really good side, I think. And Nuno has got them playing to the strategy he likes. He had this very similarly at Wolves. Strong defence, two pacey wingers. Adama Traore was one of them then. And lots of quality that was brought in through the Portuguese leagues and agents even. And I've seen a lot of them, and I think they are a really interesting team. Nuno has done fantastically well with them. I think it'll be a real test for City. But I think maybe the game at the City ground recently, Pep might have learned a few lessons from that. And of course, as you mentioned, City's Wembley, and it is a factor. When you've played at Wembley lots of times, you do get used to it. If you're playing there for the first time, it can be a bit daunting. It can either drop you back or it could lift you as well. I think City will probably just have a little bit too much for Forest, but sitting on the fence here, I would never rule Forest out because they're saying they are a really good side. They know what they're doing. They all believe in the strategy that's set out. Got some quality players, but I think overall, as I've said to you there, I think City will just edge it. But they are two really interesting semi-finals.
Yeah. Helen, it's interesting. Phil mentioned that game at the City Ground there. And obviously a lot of us as fans have that in the back of our minds as a worry from recent weeks. But Guardiola's doing something different than what he was doing in that game. In that game, he had Savinho playing. He was playing with his wingers high and wide. In the last few weeks, he's talked about it himself as well, actually, recently, about playing with the fullbacks high and wide and having more bodies in the middle. That could stop Forest's counter-attack threat.
It could, and you know, when you hear Pep talking about it and saying, I want to try this, we'll try with a bit more of the width, it is promising because sometimes you think he's just going to keep doing it and keep doing it and keep doing it and get the same results. So it's, you know, say he is the master after all, but he can also be a bit stubborn. I do think it then worries me about people then that wouldn't get to play. And going off recent performances, I know we've spoken before about Doku and stuff. It's kind of, it's 100% not my job, and that's a very good thing too. I wouldn't know how to pick the best lineup for that, but you know, Pep does, so we'll see.
Yeah, it does. If he is going to go with the fullbacks option, Phil, it does mean that. I mean, you waxed lyrical about Jeremy Doku earlier in the show, but it means he can't fit into the team unless it's from the bench, and that. Given the performances he's had this week, it kind of feels harsh not to give him the reward of a start, doesn't it?
But maybe, yeah. And he's one of those players who, at this time in his career, is best off the bench as an impact player because he's got such pace. He's unpredictable, isn't he, to say the least. So maybe that might be his best bet at the moment, to play him off the bench, because he certainly, as I say, he's frustrated me in lots of measure when I've watched him for City, because you think, this is a real player here, there's something here, definitely. And then often he won't deliver, but he's just suddenly started to deliver as a substitute. So maybe Pep thinks, for the time being, that is best for him. And as you say, you have got to watch that pace and width of Nottingham Forest, because that's basically how they've been doing teams all season. They've perfected the art of it. They're really good at it, thanks to the manager who loves playing that way. So I wonder whether Pep might think Doku on this occasion, maybe keep him back on the bench, either as a late impact sub or maybe someone to come on to change the game if things aren't going City's way. So if he did that, I wouldn't be overly critical of him. I wouldn't be overly critical anyway, because I think Pep Guardiola knows slightly more about football than me. But I think maybe that's the position for Doku at this time.
Yeah. Not to make you feel even more nervous about this, Helen, there are only three managers that have beaten Guardiola more than Nuno Espirito Santo. They are Ancelotti, Mourinho and Klopp, which is quite a good club to be among that.
Eesh. Honestly, that doesn't make me feel very good at all. That's not great. We've had results against them all, though. Do you know what I mean? It is possible. We've done it before. And I'm just going to throw out there, it's my birthday on Sunday.
That's how football works. You've ruined it.
They've done it before. We had that one of the most boring derbies ever on my birthday once. It was horrendous. So, yeah, I'm taking responsibility if this all goes wrong.
Any other fears as well about Guardiola and semi-finals, Helen? Because he quite often gets to this stage of the FA Cup, and albeit the context is they've been playing Liverpool or they've been playing Chelsea or they've been playing one of the other top teams, and they've also been in the race for the title for the Champions League. They don't have those distractions, but Guardiola's semi-final record isn't fantastic.
No, but like you said previously, there's been other things going on. Now, I can't work out if that's going to benefit us this season or not. If this is all Pep's going for, if this is all his galaxy mind is working on, what is going to happen? Because, I think maybe semis have been overlooked or maybe even overthought, which can also cause us a lot of problems. So we'll just have to see. I don't want anything to be taken for granted. Like you said, you look at the teams and you didn't fancy either, not fancy any of them. You know, I think people always tell, will come to us and be, oh, City will do it, City will do it. And it's just, I don't know. I'm not quite as certain.
Well, I was at a semi-final when Nuno Espirito Santo was manager of Wolves in 2019, and Wolves were 2-0 up with 11 minutes to go to Watford, and lost 3-2 after extra time. There's a guy called, you may remember him, Gerard Deulofeu, who played at Everton. He got him from Barcelona, and this guy on his day could be something else. And unfortunately for Nuno, this was his day, and he scored a couple of sensational goals. They won 3-2. And then in the final, of course, City went on to beat Watford 6-0, which still, I don't, it shouldn't make me laugh really, but it was one of the great lines of all time. When we were in the press room afterwards, Watford had lost 6-0. And one of their guys came through, who I knew, and he tapped me on the shoulder. He said, well, I'll tell you what, I said, that could have gone a bit better, couldn't it? 6-0. Blimey. But, I mean, they were like, well, we've just been thrashed by a great side. But Nuno won't have happy memories of semi-finals himself. So how that works, I don't know. Because I recall that game, Wolves had it sewn up. There was only one team going to win. And suddenly, as these things can do, it all turned on its head. So he will have memories of Wembley that he might want to erase as well, or, you know, he could end up with further bad memories. I, as I say, to go back to what I said, I just think overall, given City have picked up in the last couple of weeks, I still think City and that experience that Helen and yourself have talked about, I think they will still have a little bit too much on the day.
Yeah. Just final question, Phil. Do you think, how important is the FA Cup for City's season now? Because in any season, you can win or lose in a cup competition. You know, a deflection can knock you out of the cup. It's one of those things. But there is also the possibility that this is, well, we know it's going to be some players' final shot at a trophy at City. So it kind of feels like there's a bit of poignancy to this one.
I agree. You know, you look at people like Kevin De Bruyne, who is leaving City at the end of the season, one of the all-time great Premier League players. And it's actually good to see fans recognising that as well, because when he was taken off Everton on Saturday, he got a standing ovation when he went off. The whole ground rose to him. And you don't see that very often, but they recognise a player of his stature. You look at others who maybe go. Bernardo Silva may go. Ilkay Gundogan, what's going to happen with his future? So they'll be determined as well. So, you know, people like De Bruyne will want to go out with a trophy. Yes, the top five this season, as it is, will be huge for City, given all the traumas that they've been through and the disappointments this season. But those top players love trophies, and Pep Guardiola loves trophies. And I saw his reaction when they won at Bournemouth. It was a bit like the other night. He was absolutely overjoyed. And for the whole of that game, he was as animated as I'd seen him for a very long time. And that showed that the FA Cup means a lot. And to me, the FA Cup still means a lot. Some people are trying to downgrade it, you know, and in a way, it's almost succeeded. But I think for City to win a trophy, to keep that trophy run going, is incredibly important. And I think we'll see that in the way he approaches it and the way the players approach it at the weekend.
Yeah. Well, it's time to put your money where your mouth is, because it's charity bet time on the podcast. We had no correct predictions on last week's show, so we stay on £1,300 raised for the season so far for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. William Hill is giving us three £10 correct score singles to try and raise as much as we can for them, and it's the small matter of this weekend's FA Cup semi-final to predict. Now, rules for this one, we need a score on 90 minutes, so no extra time, no penalties, nothing like that. We heard that Daniel Storey's gone for a 2-2 draw at 90 minutes, and then Forest to win on penalties, which doesn't matter. Full-time score is all we want. So that 2-2 is 14-1 and £140 if he's right. Phil, what are you having for this one?
I will say Manchester City 2, Nottingham Forest 0.
A 2-0 City win on 90 minutes is 13-2 and £65 if you're right. Helen, what are you having for this?
I think I'd had a better night's sleep when you asked me this, because I said 3-1, and now I think that's very optimistic.
It's funny the number of times the charity bet makes the fans go, well, like all the way through the preview, they're like, well, I'm not really sure about this, this is nervy. And then you say, well, what's your prediction? They go, 7-0. Just like the mismatch there is always there, but you know. Helen, 3-1 is 12-1 and £120 if you're right. Phil, no pressure. But we have a history of podcast debutants winning their first charity bet. So good luck.
Let's hope it continues that tradition.
Fingers crossed. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for information on how to gamble responsibly, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now then, we've had a question a few weeks back on the podcast from Tom, who wanted to know why Stuart Pearce is often cited as City's worst manager when there have been plenty who have been in charge for relegations. So since he's a Forest legend, and it was 20 years ago that he took charge at City last month, we thought this week was the episode to look back to life in 2005. Stuart Pearce joined City as a player in the summer of 2001.
I liked Stuart Pearce as a player at City, and I think part of what I liked about him was he was just a very famous name joining City after a relegation. And my recollection is that he did all right, scored in his debut, and was an important person to have around the squad in that promotion push, I think.
That's City fan Richard Burns. He, like a lot of the fans at that time, thought Pearce was a good addition to the squad under the new manager Kevin Keegan. Dan Burke felt the same.
I was really delighted when we signed Stuart Pearce because I felt that the side that had been relegated from the Premier League the previous season was really lacking in strong leaders. You know, that's a big problem that we'd had under Joe Royal, and you know, Stuart Pearce was the ideal captain. You know, I've been a fan of him throughout his career, during his time at Nottingham Forest and West Ham and for England, of course. And you know, even though his best years were behind him when he came to City, I thought he, you know, he was generally excellent that season under Kevin Keegan.
Pearce only had one season on the pitch for City, and Dom Farrell says it was largely a success.
Got off to a flyer, didn't it, with that free kick against Watford, the first game of the season. And ended a little bit in farce with Dave Besson trying to let him score a penalty for a 100th career goal that he hit wide anyway. In between that, I think his year at City was kind of followed the path of Keegan's team overall. Once Keegan went to what became his favoured 3-5-2 and Pearce was on the left of a back three behind Danny Theato having a great season, it went pretty well. Theato's probably is the main character in Pearce's best moment as a City player, when Theato was sent off for flinging an elbow towards Steen Nedergaard from Norwich, and Pearce felt the Norwich player went down a little bit too easily and spent the rest of the game bullying him as Anhail Berkovic inspired City won 3-1.
Pearce retired at the end of that season as City won Division 1 and were promoted back to the Premier League in 2002. He joined Keegan's coaching staff, and when the manager resigned 2.5 seasons later, it was Pearce that took temporary charge.
When he took over as interim manager following Kevin Keegan's departure, like everyone else, I initially assumed it was just going to be a temporary position. But I was also looking forward to seeing what he could bring to the table as a coach. You know, he had this reputation throughout his career as a leader, and he also came across like a keen student of the game. So it all felt really promising. And then that run of results towards the end of the season, which ended with us just, you know, being a missed Robbie Fowler penalty away from qualifying for the UEFA Cup, it meant the club couldn't really afford to not appoint him on a permanent basis. I think they were sort of embarrassed into doing it almost. And, you know, it felt like the foundations were really in place for a promising future with Pearce at the helm. And the fans singing, "All we are saying is give Pearce a chance," showed how much everyone was behind him. And I think we were all really excited to see what was going to come next.
That spell as interim boss had an effect on a lot of fans.
When he was made manager, and then sort of regret this now, like the foolishness of it, but I was so excited, because I was taken in by how well he did in that caretaker stint, where we went from having Keegan, who'd clearly, clearly the spark had gone, and it was just rubbish watching City at that point. And then Pearce comes in, it's revitalised, we win a load of games, we push for Europe, and it was just, it felt fresh all of a sudden, so I was really glad when he got the job permanently, and really optimistic.
With one game of the 2004-05 season to go, Pearce was confirmed as the next permanent City manager. In his 8 games to that point, he'd won 4 and drawn 3, leading the club to the brink of European qualification by league position. A 1-1 draw on the final day with Middlesbrough saw City just miss out, but a mixture of an energetic new manager, bizarre tactics in sending the goalkeeper up front, a sunny day, and the end of the season good form had rejuvenated the feeling around Eastlands. The next season would start in a similar vein, and City were in the top 6 in the middle of November, but it didn't last.
It went wrong quite quickly. In terms of what went wrong over time, I think he was tactically inept, and I think he outwardly, like, you'd look at him and think he's probably quite a motivational person. But if you look at the way the team played, don't think that's true. And you look at his job since then, doesn't seem that he's great at motivating a group of players to lift their performance. And so I think maybe what he had at the start was he wasn't Keegan. And I love Kevin Keegan, but clearly his time at City had run its course and Pierce came in and he wasn't that.
With 10 games to go of Pierce's first full season in charge, City were ninth. They would finish 15th with a run that saw the team lose 9 and win just 1 of their final matches.
It really felt like the bubble had burst after a good end to the previous season and a good start to his first full season, and the wheels had started to come off. And this was also around the time he was being touted as a potential future England senior manager, having been such a successful player for England. And I don't think him taking the under-21s job in 2007 did him many favours inside the club. And a lot of fans, I think, also felt it was a sign that he wasn't fully committed to City and the task at hand, and was kind of looking at his own career and the future, really.
Dom Farrell points to one decision that just didn't work out for Pierce.
The signing of Georges Samaras, I think, is what did for him, really, because there wasn't a lot of money about. The Wright Phillips money had kind of saved the club. But Pierce was, and City were pretty shrewd in the transfer market at the time. Nearly brought in Pep Guardiola on free transfer, of course. And he had the strike partnership of Darius Vassell and Andy Cole at the start of the 05-06 season. Looked pretty tidy. They then spent all the money they'd saved up on Samaras, who did have plenty of ability, but, you know, was as flaky as the drawer full of chocolate in the ice cream van.
City had become a solid mid-table Premier League club, the sort of club that could be expected to deliver some sort of success for the fans in a season of overachievement, whether that was a good run in the league and European qualification, or a day out at Wembley in one of the domestic cups. But City flattered to deceive, and Pierce's final season was characterised by the team's inability to score.
There was the couple of FA Cup quarter-final defeats as well, which were similarly bleak. It started well, but I think it is that statistic of just no home goal after the turn of the year. That's the sort of thing that follows you around. I mean, that's not going to happen to anyone again, as much as Leicester have had a goal this year. And that sort of makes him viewed as a little bit of a joke figure in coaching terms, which is maybe a little bit harsh, but there we go.
Dan says there were antics that, looking back, don't look good.
Him putting David James up front and having the beanie horse on the touchline, you know, at the time that was very fun and endearing, and when things are going well on the pitch, that's how things feel. But when you can't back it up with results, when the results start to go badly, I think it just makes you look a bit silly, really. And ultimately, you know, Pierce didn't take City down. He kept them in the division even during that awful 06-07 season. And perhaps his time at the club isn't remembered completely fairly, and perhaps he doesn't deserve the legacy he has as one of City's worst ever managers. But, you know, I think you have to say the football played in that season was terrible. The results were even worse. And the squad that he had at his disposal should have been capable of better. And I think you have to say the fact he hasn't really done anything else as a coach since then, and you know, now works on TalkSport, vindicates the feelings a lot of City fans have towards him.
That's a completely different view to how Pierce is seen at Nottingham Forest. Despite a couple of unsuccessful managerial reigns there, his time as a player still has him cemented as a club legend. Here's journalist and Forest fan Daniel Storey.
He's on our Mount Rushmore because he was captain, he was the leader, he was everything that kind of synonymised Forest in those late Clough days for the better. From the opposite end of the country to Brian Clough, but has basically everything Clough wants in a player, like complete commitment. The 1991 FA Cup final is sold, understandably, as Brian Clough's great tragedy. You know, we lose that final because Gascoigne isn't sent off and Des Walker scores an own goal and everything falls apart, and Clough never wins an FA Cup, and a year later it becomes clear that his drinking and his, you know, his alcoholism is taking over his personality. But what's overlooked is it was also a tragedy for Stuart Pearce. He would have lifted that FA Cup, and I so wish that happened for him. He's an absolute idol. And whereas at City, I guess because he wasn't there as long, the managerial stint taints it. There's just none of that at Forest.
So while City have had managers that have overseen spells of decline and haven't been able to sort out problems that have led to relegations, the feeling that City could, perhaps should, have been able to achieve more with what they had in the mid-noughties is most likely the reason for the strength of the fans' feeling about that period under Pierce. It might have started brightly and with plenty of optimism, but that faded far too quickly. Supporters can forgive a lot, but a team that doesn't score goals is never going to be one that's remembered with any great fondness.
Hi, this is Andy Morrison, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
Email the show through our website, bluemoonpodcast.com.
I look back there at Stuart Pearce's time at City. Helen, I'm very sorry for having to make you relive the season where City decided not to score goals, but that's by the by. Phil, you're about to experience something now as a podcast debutant. Would you like to pick a number for me? 1, 2, or 3?
3.
Number 3, okay.
Have you got a theory on City that needs closer inspection, or just something to ask us? Because this is your section. Read something odd into Pep's tone or inflection, or a novel idea to improve team selection. Sick of these jingles? Well, give it a mention, or maybe something worthwhile to bring to our attention. Let us know, Blues, because it's your listeners' questions. Oh, yes, it really is.
I love that bit, Phil, because it like the look of mystery on everybody's face when they experience it for the first time. Higgy is very much one of a kind.
I think that the one where he goes a bit Marky Smith's my favourite, but that's another solid.
That's all of them. Get in touch with your questions at Blue Moon Podcast on Blue Sky. You can email contact@bluemoonpodcast.com as well. That's what Joe has done on the emails. He says, I was embarrassed that the Villa fans were singing about the amount of empty seats inside the Etihad on Tuesday. But shouldn't this illustrate to the club that £71 for adults is just too much for a game? It was a crucial game against a Champions League rival, and Guardiola always says he wants the crowd to play their part. So is the club hampering itself by selling tickets at that price? Helen, I'm going to come to you in a second, but first, Guardiola was asked about this in the post-match press conference. So let's have a listen to what he said.
No, we won't. I am in the sight of the people. So I'm a supporter for Manchester City as well. I don't have to pay the tickets, but I understand it's with the feeling. I said in the previous ones, the clubs are alive when they have disagree or agree or whatever with the club, they can express and the club will listen to arrive in agreement. So I'm not saying who I am to say that is right or wrong. So every time when I go to a theatre, I go to a cinema, I want a concert, I pay the ticket and I want to, you know, I want to see something that I like. It's the same. So, of course, we want them yes or yes here and full stadium every time. But the club is open, I'm pretty sure, because I know the club, that when they are in disagree, we're not that subject in any subject. That's why the club is always alive.
He's in a bit of a difficult position there, because obviously he wants the fans in the stadium, but he like the club has its policies. Helen, you couldn't make it to the game against Villa in the end. Do you know if your ticket sold on the exchange or anything like that?
No, it didn't. I'm just dusting off my soapbox, but it didn't. I listed it with a couple of days to go. I was really hoping to go. I had my first child in October last year, and I had made all plans to get to go to the original day and time. My husband had booked the day off his pub job so he could have the baby while I could go. Obviously, with the changes, understandable. It's part of football. Coming off the back of a 4-day weekend, it was just, you know, sleep changes. I was too tired. I couldn't go. I listed it on the exchange and it did not sell, which it has done previously. I've used the exchange only a couple of times. I prefer to transfer to friends and family. But that's the first time, and it's interesting when you hear Pep, and I know Pep's in a difficult position with it, but he's saying, oh, you know, you choose to go to the theatre. I go to the theatre because I want to watch something. That doesn't apply with football. It's frustrating, I think, that this is sort of coinciding with a season that's not been at the same levels as previous seasons. It goes far beyond this. It's not fans aren't coming because they don't like the football being played. Fans aren't coming because they simply cannot afford it. Other life reasons, we've gone, you know, through this so many times, but it bears repeating. I know the fan groups put together that brilliant pamphlet that made it very, very clear the issue with the pricing at the moment at the ground. It was a Tuesday night, and for a family of four to go, it was hundreds and hundreds. Like, people just have not got that. And the timings, the 8 o'clock kickoff, not even 7:45, you know, it makes it not possible for so many people.
Yeah. Phil, the Etihad was noticeably more empty on Tuesday night than it has been at any point for this season, to the point where the Villa fans did pick up on it and were chanting about it. But this is almost an issue now that kind of has to go across fan bases. And like, I understand why the Villa fans would make fun of it, but at the same time, there is a bigger picture here, isn't there? That it doesn't just affect City fans. This affects all football fans.
I think we've seen at several grounds this season banners along the lines of "Don't exploit loyalty." I think you've seen it at quite a few Premier League clubs. And obviously this is playing into what the City fans are unhappy about at the moment. I find it sometimes when friends of mine say they're getting tickets for a game and stuff like that, the prices they quote to me are astronomical. And I don't know how they afford it, but that is what the fans are talking about, isn't it? They know that they're loyal. They know Manchester City fans. I'm not having it that these Manchester City fans have suddenly appeared on the scene, you know, because Man City have become incredibly successful. I remember City getting huge crowds when I was a kid at the old Main Road. They got big, big crowds when they were in the third tier. So these people are very, very loyal. And it's a difficult one for Pep Guardiola, as you say, because he's got to walk on that dividing line. But it's certainly a subject for discussion. It's a difficult one. I'm not privy to pricing policies of football clubs, but I certainly sympathise with fans when they say it's a very, very expensive business, because friends of mine have season ticket for other clubs and then two or three of them want to go to a game. And as Helen said, it can add up to hundreds of pounds. And that is certainly something that there has to be a discussion around.
Yeah. Helen, one other quick thing to mention. You posted about the club's policy for next season this week as well, which is around season tickets for next season. As of next season, season ticket holders must personally attend 10 games. So this is a minimum of your ticket being used by yourself for 10 of the 19 games. And the ticket must be used 16 of 19 times in total, whether that's transferred to friends and family as well. This is something that will affect you, won't it?
Yeah, 100%. I was actually sickened to read that. And I know it's one of those things that people will be like, oh, it's hard to look at people when you're not in that situation and not understand, but it's going to impact so many people when you look into it. So, as mentioned, I became mum for the first time 6 months ago. Probably explains a lot of my inane babble today, so apologies. But, you know, with that, I found out way before the end of last season, before renewals were being discussed, I emailed the club straight away. I've had a season ticket for a long, long time and said, can I defer for next season? Because I know that I am just not going to get to that many games. And I know they did it during COVID as well, so I know it is possible, the deferral system, and was told, no, we can't defer, you'll have to go. If you give up your ticket, it's gone forever. And obviously the club are no longer issuing new season tickets, so I'd lose that. And obviously this situation is not unique. It's going to impact so many people, so many mothers, but beyond that it's going to impact carers, people that work shift patterns, people with unpredictable illnesses and conditions. It wasn't ideal, but at least when I spent 8 weeks in hospital following the birth of my daughter because she was premature, I was able to transfer the ticket. Admin I wouldn't have liked, but, you know, I would make sure that ticket was used. I was actually in a hospital bed doing it to make sure that I'd be able to maintain my ticket for the future. That itself was ridiculous. But then add on to that, with these new rules that are coming in, I would lose my ticket because I wasn't personally going. From the outset, I can see that they're, you know, the club saying it's to make sure that the tickets are used, they're not just being, not one person having it and selling it for every game to gain profit and all stuff like that. Right, if that's your concern, Viagogo, these partnerships we're seeing, it completely invalidates the point. Where we've seen empty seats when we've not even had these these issues we had on Tuesday night has been the corporate. None of it makes sense. And I can guarantee a woman was not involved in this decision because, say, evening kickoff changes, there's so much that would take you out, but not going to 10 games personally. It's like, okay, so say you can book babysitters, you can arrange, you can do everything you can, but if your baby is ill, if you are ill, I am in the South Stand lower tier, so I am not going to, endanger myself and my unborn child when I was heavily pregnant by going to games, because I don't expect everyone else standing around me to, you know, and to be fair, the last few I went to, everyone was very sweet and was like trying to high five me rather than hug me after a game. But I'm not going to do that. So I was in hospitalised early. My daughter was then in hospital for a while herself and I was in with her. You know, these are life consequences. These are things that happen in life. And to review that, and the years to come, I'm expecting not to get to a few games. A lot of our friends that we go to the game with are fathers, and they have to make choices now about, you know, I'm not going to have to give that one a miss, I'll trade my ticket. But at the end of the day, we're still, we're fans first and foremost, but they want to treat us like customers, then treat us like customers. The best way to succeed in business is getting profit from retained customers, not constantly expensive advertising campaigns and billboards to get new ones. You know, there's no value. It's this, the whole thing with the legacy fans, and they say it goes beyond just the issues of the patriarchal society, which we've not got time to get into, and you know, someone needs to someone think of the forum load time. But it goes beyond that. Think about people who are carers, people that have shift patterns. You know, some of our good friends, they work some weekends, work some evening shifts. The games chop and change. You can't guarantee that. And these are the people that are meant to be, you know, the core. We know we're not the core anymore, but, you know, this is real life and this impacts. A good friend of our, you know, one of our parish, Nick, one of my best friends, we both share, share sounds weird, we don't share it between us, we both have the same problem with our joints. That means some days you think you're on top of the world and some days you can barely get out of bed. These are unpredictable problems. There's people going through treatments, there's so many people this will impact. And I've spoken to a few other mothers with young children in similar situations to myself who are also long-term season ticket holders, home and away, and they're looking at solutions around this that is literally going to revolve having to have almost like a burner phone to guarantee that you are being scanned into the match if you can't make it, which makes the whole thing illogical. So it's incredibly short-sighted, it's incredibly heartbreaking, and we're told her game two, and again, this doesn't just affect women, it's going to affect so many people. It just seems incredibly short-sighted, and you know, the club haven't even announced that much about it. The way the announcement was sort of made, the article dropped, it was, you know, I'm really hoping there'll be more updates. And I know City Matters, the Food Bank Support Strut 1984, they're all over it. And I just, yeah, I really hope that they'll reconsider, because it's a real slap in the face, you know. And, you know, City is a big part of my identity as well, and for all fans, and to be going through this and then thinking you're having to bend over backwards in already a difficult time so you're not kicked out for next week, it's madness.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'll calm down now.
it's fine. It's absolutely fine. I was enthralled listening to you, and it's a topic that's going to keep coming back. It's absolutely fine. Phil, we're going to finish with a question from Nicole on the emails, who says James McAtee finally seems to be getting some more minutes. I know he's young and inexperienced, but he's played a lot at Sheffield United. Should we be concerned that he keeps missing really good chances? It was against Crystal Palace he missed two or three big chances before he got his goal in the end. And then against Villa on Tuesday night, the lob was a difficult chance. I'm not gonna slate him for missing that one, but there was one at the near post in the second half that I thought, how on earth has he not put that one in? Is there anything to be concerned about there?
I don't think so. I think he's a young player. Young players learn, they make mistakes, they miss chances. To me, I would look on the positive and say City have got an outstanding young player on their hands. What the future holds for him, we don't know. It depends on how he sees his future, how Pep sees his future. But I wouldn't be too concerned about too many missed chances. I'm not going to use the horrible old cliche about as long as he's getting in there, that's fine, because you do actually want him to put it in as well. But I think I'd prefer to look at the glass half full and say that, yeah, he'll take those chances eventually, and he's a really fine young player who I think, given time, will make a big contribution to Manchester City. So I will be very positive in the answer to that.
Yeah, it's interesting as well. You said before about interest from Nottingham Forest, and we've also heard about Leverkusen potentially be interested as well. The Nottingham Forest one is really interesting, because obviously City are rumoured to be interested in Morgan Gibbs-White, and there's almost a situation there. If you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
Well, possibly. I don't know whether City will be more wary about letting people go, given what's happened with Cole Palmer and, of course, Liam Delap. But I do think there's a little bit of revisionism gone on there. You know, at the start of last season, no one had said Liam Delap would have got in Manchester City's team. Suddenly he scores some goals for Ipswich and, ooh, you know, maybe. And obviously Cole Palmer wanted to get away anyway. Pep made that very clear. So possibly there's a deal to be done there. Morgan Gibbs-White is a very good player, but I just wonder whether Pep might be a little bit more reluctant than he was before just to send young players off, unless he genuinely feels that Morgan Gibbs-White is a real change maker for Manchester City and he's a player he wants and he feels he can sacrifice McAtee to do that. But on the surface, to me, he looks a really good young player. And that's obviously true if you've got people like Nottingham Forest and actually Bayer Leverkusen, the current Bundesliga champions, albeit maybe not for much longer, showing an interest in him. That shows his pedigree, his talent. And I do think lots of clubs will look at Manchester City's academy and think, can we pinch some players from them? Because we've seen Morgan Rodgers at Villa, again, Delap, you know, people like Palmer go. City clearly have this great production line, but sometimes it's a difficult choice for clubs like Manchester City. They've got to weigh up, will these people play regular parts for us? Because Manchester City and what they need is at such an elite level, so high. But it's an interesting one that I hadn't really thought of that until you mentioned it. But Morgan Gibbs-White, a very good player. But I just wonder whether Pep might just think, maybe hang on to McAtee a little bit longer. But again, as with Palmer, it depends on what McAtee sees his future as being. Does he want to play right away, which is what Palmer obviously did? But to me, he's a very good young player. But equally, Morgan Gibbs-White is also a very good player as well.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on it, that's for sure. That's it for this week on the Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests for this one, to Helen Powell.
Thank you, David.
And Phil McNulty.
Enjoy the weekend.
There is a clip of this week's Nostalgia episode coming up shortly. That was City fan Andrew Wolfe picking out his choices for the games that made me, and it's available from patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast right now. I'll be back next week after the FA Cup semi-final, but because of the Wolves game now being played on the Friday night, look out for the show a little bit earlier in the week. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
We'd moved, actually, at this point. We'd moved to from Harveray to Chadderton. Obviously, Boundary Park's pretty much, it's a mile away. And I remember my mum came. My mum and dad came to this one. So my dad got the tickets. Obviously, it was difficult to get tickets for City back then, because even though they were at the lowest point, they were still popular. They were probably gaining more popularity at that point. I remember it kicking off all over the ground. And I remember walking back afterwards as well. And obviously we'd seen it. We'd seen the trouble all over the ground. And we saw, I remember my mum. So there's a dual carriageway. And don't try this at home, obviously. But I remember us running across the dual carriageway at the end of the game or after the game on the way home, and I remember my mum trying to climb over the central reservation of this dual carriageway. It was hilarious. It was hilarious to watch, and it's just one of those memories that will stick with you forever.
Yeah. So how had things changed for you as a City fan in school by this point? Because obviously City are now at the lowest point. You're kind of wearing that as a badge of honour.
Always wore it as a badge of honour. I'll never understand how we get the label Glory Hunters and how we get up when we've seen this. You know, kids of the late 80s and 90s, this is what we grew up with. We deserve what's happened now, really.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast, and join us again next time for another episode.